will speak about Israel and the new Middle East. And when you talk about Israel and the new Middle East, I noticed that when I wrote the name of my presentation to Stefan, I wrote new, großgeschrieben, with a capital N, and then he translated it into German as kleingeschrieben, new Middle East. There's always the danger of falling into generalizations. The term new Middle East was coined by the former Israeli president Shimon Peres in the 1990s, the era of euphoria, the era of the Oslo Accords, the end of the Cold War, when we all believed that a beautiful new world was before us. I guess many people in Germany thought the same after the end of the Cold War and the breaking down of the Berlin Wall. But this was the new Middle East, großgeschrieben, new. And the vision of Peres and many Israelis at that time was that the Middle East would move forward not only into an era of peace, of the lack of conflict, but also the new Middle East was also going to be a place of economic progress. Economic progress which was not only based on the natural resources of oil and gas, which have been used there for thousands of years, but also on people, the innovation and the energy of people who would cooperate among themselves, with each other. But unfortunately, the new Middle East that we have today, whether you write it with a big or a small N, is today very, very far from the vision of Shimon Peres. And I was watching his funeral a few months ago. I had the privilege of working with him many years ago when I was research coordinator of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. And I thought that his death was also a defining moment in a way for the end of a certain dream, of a certain era of hopes. Because today's Middle East is characterized by two elements which make everything else very difficult. Instability and unpredictability. During the Cold War, we had stability. Whether in times of conflict or in the lack of conflict, there was stability in many parts of the world. There was stability in Europe, whether you were in Western Europe or Eastern Europe, and predictability. In the Middle East, you could predict with pretty good precision the reactions and actions of states, of leaders. The system was pyramidal. If the president of Egypt decided to go to war with Israel, this is what happened. And if he decided to make peace with Israel, and it was his decision, this is what happened again. There was a very, very clear pyramid of decision-making, and if you could convince or disconvince the people at the top to do something, then this would happen. All this predictability, all this stability has gone with the wind over the past 5 years. Perhaps the civil war in Syria is only one example of it. The whole region is full of conflict. Some we talk about, some we don't talk about. I will mention briefly in my paper. But it makes it very, very difficult for us as political scientists, as international relations scholars, to analyze trends, and it makes it difficult for us to advise the people in positions of power what to do. Because the strong element of instability brings a reaction of not to do anything. When the world around you is up in flames, you just want to sit back and wait and judge your reaction at the right time. And who knows when the right time will come. Arab regimes in the Middle East before the so-called Arab Spring, or I should really say Arab Winter, or Arab something, were pretty much predictable. They were mainly concerned with self-preservation. And that meant, inevitably, upholding the Sykes-Picot borders in the Middle East, borders which were determined at the end of the First World War, which had nothing to do with the geographical or the social reality on the ground. Sykes and Nicot, a British and a French official, took a map and took a pencil, and they were drawing lines, and these demarcation lines existed at least until very recently. And when we hear the ISIS people, the so-called Islamic Caliphate state, people talking about abolishing the borders of Sykes-Picot, they talk about abolishing borders which they believe were enforced upon them by the Europeans. It's not a coincidence that the borders of many Arab states in the Middle East consist of straight lines. If you look at countries which are either completely straight or they have a little bit of something in the middle, these straight lines cross everything natural, mountains, rivers, sometimes villages in the middle, and what makes one person on this side of the street Sudanese and another person Egyptian is quite difficult to explain to the young people of the region. But it seems that within this fight for self-preservation of the Arab regimes, their hatred, their animosity towards Israel, was very often the only unifying element they could find. And they could unify their populations in the hatred, in the conflict against Israel, in what was basically a system of competition for influence, for hegemony within the Sunni Arab world. The end of the Cold War brought about what we call in Israel the Oslo Decade, named after the Oslo Accords. Oslo is where the first Israeli-Palestinian meetings took place in the early 90s. And this was an attempt to achieve a limited, practicable solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It was not comprehensive. It was not over-encompassing, but it was an attempt to provide practical solutions to the problems on the ground, and unfortunately, to a large extent, it failed. And Israel then withdrew from Lebanon in 2000, from Gaza in 2005, and these withdrawals can be seen as a reaction to the failure of the Oslo Accords, and an attempt to batten down the hatches. There's this wonderful German saying, I use it often, die Schotten dicht machen. And this was an attempt to close the Schotten, to concentrate on defensible borders, borders that are easy to defend, with getting rid of some of the settlements in Gaza and in the northern West Bank. And at least in the medium term, to kind of freeze the situation until the region makes deeper change possible. And unfortunately, I can't really see any conditions which would make a deeper change possible in the likely of within the next few years. My paper is really divided into three parts. And I've been asked to talk for 20 minutes, so I'll be quite brief. And if anybody wishes to have the full version of the paper, they could have it later by email or anything. I want to talk about three points briefly. I want to speak about the strategic impact of the Iranian nuclear threat and the Obama-Iran treaty on Israel's security policies and security perceptions. I will not repeat what was said so far. I'm no nuclear scientist. I cannot analyze the plus and minuses of the treaty, but I will talk about its impact on perceptions and on security policies. The second point is I'd like to talk about the effects of the Arab Spring, or as I said, Arab Winter, on Israel's security posture and on border security. And then I will try to ask and answer the question of what do these implications mean for Israel and for the German engagement in the region. First, about the security impact of the Iranian nuclear program, the Iranian nuclear threat, and the Obama-Iran treaty. Very, very deep impact on Israel, on political, on military, and also on social levels. I think that it's even too early for us to fully understand the impact of this treaty on Israeli perceptions, not only on Israeli actions, there's not been many actions since then, but on Israeli perceptions. First of all, the Israeli military reaction to the growing nuclear threat from Iran was the technological development and the military deployment of a multi-layer missile and rocket defense system. The world has never known. It's also greatly expanded Israel's strategic defensive capabilities. Submarines are only one part of strategic defensive capabilities. They are perhaps a very sexy part because you see the submarines, they're very nice, and they're German, of course, so they must be good. But it's a multi-layer system. I'll say a few words about that. The missile defense system, without getting into too many details, is an amazing system which is like a layered cake. I guess you could call it a kind of a multi-chocolate cake, which means that Israel now has the capacity to intercept incoming missiles and rockets at different distances and different heights. If we look at Iran is here, to simplify things, and Israel here, it's about 2,000 kilometers, maybe just a little bit more than from here to London. And it's not enough for Iran to have a nuclear bomb or nuclear warhead to threaten Israel. They have to get it over Israeli territory. They can do it with airplanes. That's a very old-fashioned way. It was done by the Americans over Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the Second World War. They can do it with missiles, which are safer, which are faster, and much more difficult to shoot down. And therefore, over the last decade and a half, Israel developed a system which can shoot down incoming missiles at ranges of several tens of kilometers, hundreds of kilometers, or thousands of kilometers. And if we think of a missile being fired from Iran, it goes out of the stratosphere, into space, and then comes down into Israel. So, without getting too technical, it's fired at a very high speed, and it falls at a very high speed. But it is at the slowest when it's at the peak. So if you can get it, think about a football. If I'm throwing a football up, of course it starts very fast, and then slow, 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 it can't overcome the gravity anymore, and it falls down to Earth. And so the highest point, which could be perhaps 400 kilometers over the Earth, that is where you have to hit the missile. Now, the Iranian missile would pretty much fit, I think, on this stage. I think we may have to move this wooden car, but there'll be some space. Think about a small missile moving at about 2,000 kilometers an hour, and you have to hit it 400 kilometers over the Earth before it falls on top of you. 10, 15 years ago, this would have sounded like total nonsense, like space fiction. It is working. The system has been developed. It's working. It's being tested all the time. And it is working to such an extent that even tiny, small rockets, which are 1 or 2 meters long, fired from Gaza on Israeli cities, can be intercepted and be shot down before they hit their target. Someone said it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. Absolutely not. It's like trying to hit a needle in a pile of needles. That's about 400 kilometers high. So a great technological achievement, which makes Israel safer, but never 100% safe. There was an old saying during the Cold War, one bomber will always get through. And that was why the arms race produced by the superpowers, they had so many thousands and later tens of thousands of nuclear warheads, because it was enough that only a small number, most of them could be shot down on the way, but only a small number could get through. And Israel, being such a small country, is very vulnerable to a nuclear attack by Iran. Iran is 60 times larger than Israel. And Israeli centers of population are so small. If some of you have been to Tel Aviv, you can stand almost at one side of Tel Aviv and shout to your friend on the other side. So small and very, very vulnerable to a nuclear attack. But there is a risk. If you have very good anti-missile systems, you may be tempted to take more risks. It may produce adventurism. It may produce overconfidence. And on the one hand, it's a great technological achievement, and it has also helped the Israeli high-tech industries very much, because these technologies sprung a lot of companies, a lot of startups. But we have to be very careful not to rely only on defensive measures. And I fully agree with Professor Krauser here, who said that first and foremost, we are looking at diplomacy, we look at negotiations, but still having an ace up your sleeve that when the Iranians reach a stage which they have nuclear weapons, at least for the first few years, their mechanisms of firing these weapons on Israel would be relatively easy, or hopefully easy, to intercept. And therefore, we can imagine a situation in which perhaps the Iranians are firing a nuclear missile at Israel. It's being intercepted. It falls in the desert in Jordan. So not very happy for the Jordanians, but the alternative is, of course, very uncomfortable. The Obama-Iran treaty, and I don't use the beautiful name. It's not joint. It's not comprehensive. It's got such a wonderful name. I just call it the Obama-Iran Treaty. love it or hate it, is also a failure of Israeli foreign policy. It's a failure to convince the more saner countries on Earth of the insane risks that are taken by this treaty. I agree that it was the best treaty that was possible to get if you were determined to get a treaty. And sometimes it's like a bad divorce. You want to get divorced so much, you don't care how much you pay for it. But in the years and decades later, you realize the mistakes that you made. And you cannot, I see a few looks here, there must be a couple of divorced people in the room. You cannot put the toothpaste back into the tube. So it doesn't matter what President Trump, or it wouldn't have mattered what President Clinton or anybody else would have done. It's too late. The mechanism of sanctions that took about 4 or 5 years to develop and really reached its effectiveness a year and a half before the treaty would take such a long time to rebuild that it really doesn't matter. The damage to the international coalition against Iran's nuclear program has already been done. It's already been broken. And even if Trump would change it tomorrow morning, it would take years to move it one direction or the other.
Herr Spiro, yes? 20 Minuten sind jetzt um.
Sind vorbei?
Ja.
Okay, nur zwei. The other thing I wanted to briefly speak about is the effect of the Arab Spring, the changes in Arab countries, the revolutions. if we look at the map, and I wanted to show a map here of Israel, we have a situation now in which Israel is almost completely, except with the Jordan border, almost completely surrounded by jihadic, radical terrorist organizations. In the north, you have the Hezbollah that crossed the border in Lebanon. The Golan Heights mostly are controlled by jihadist organizations, whether it's Jubhat al-Nusra and other names that they have. In the Sinai, the unspoken war between the terrorist organizations which allied themselves with IS and with Al-Qaeda, whether they are called Ansar Bayt al-Maqdas or other groups, there is an ongoing war in the Sinai in which the Egyptian army is using airplanes, helicopters, tanks, and troops, and nobody reports about that in Europe. Absolutely not. The only time anybody spoke about it was when a Russian civilian airplane was blown up by the terrorists there. And of course, in Gaza, the Hamas. So, except for Jordan, Israel is now completely surrounded, not 2,000 kilometers away in Iran, but 2 meters across the Israeli borders fight Iran's proxies. And Iran certainly perceives them as proxies. Some of them would like to be very independent. They get the Iranian support. But this, in Iran's perception, is the proxy war against Israel. So it's not just a problem of some nuclear threats in the future, whether it's in 5 or 10 or 15 years. It is a problem right across Israel's border, being surrounded by Iranian proxies. I will conclude by answering the question of what does it all mean for Israel and what does it mean for Germany's engagement in the Middle East? First of all, and unfortunately, the element of political instability, the unpredictability, and the terror threats across Israel's borders mean that renewed fighting or a new war could erupt at any given moment. And in the last decades, we have seen wars erupt in the Middle East over relatively minor border incidents. So anything can happen. The Hamas has rebuilt its capabilities. The Hezbollah now has larger military capabilities than most European armies. I think when people hear the word Hezbollah, they think of some lunatics with a Kalashnikov on a mountain eating a pita. Let's get the facts clear. The Hamas has greater military capacities than most European armies. I exclude the British, the German, and the French armies, perhaps the Italian, but most others, the Hamas has greater military capabilities than them. I recently read that the British army has cut down so much that it now has more horses than tanks. I would leave it to your imagination. In the past 2 decades, Germany has played an important and sometimes a downplayed role in mediating between Israel, the Hezbollah, and the Hamas. I think this role should be encouraged. And since the future German president has realized that the 20th century is over, 17 years after it happened, I mean, slow but safe reaction, it's okay. I think that Germany has a role to play as a mediator, whether covertly or openly, that's a decision for the German government. It's usually done through the Bundestag, but has an important role to play to make sure that small border incidents do not grow to larger conflagrations. The second element is the decline, the political decline of the European Union, the euro crisis, the Brexit, the refugee crisis, the rise of right-wing parties. They all mean that the EU has really no more political role in the Middle East. The Quartet, which played a very important role in the past, is no longer an active player. I think that the euro crisis and the Brexit is ushering an era that we go back to bilateral politics. German politicians, especially German diplomats, very often hid behind the EU. And when they wanted to adopt some anti-Israel policies, they always said, well, it's not us, you know, it's the people in Brussels. We would like to help you, but these bad guys in Brussels don't let us. We're going back to the era of bilateral politics, bilateral relations. Multilateralism is suffering a setback. It's not gone, but it's certainly suffering a setback. And yes, in Israel, we do have expectations of an increased German engagement in the region, because the U.S. is no longer a valid player in the Middle East. After abandoning most of its friends in the Middle East, the U.S. has lost its credibility, whereby Germany still has a strong credibility. And last but not least, I would like to say perhaps a couple of personal words. I think that the 2017 Bundestag elections, and I'm being very careful here, I think that they would lead Germany into deep internal challenges, which would have an impact, certainly in the long term, on Germany-Israeli relations. Mm-hmm. We already see a decline in the importance of the heritage of the Holocaust in Germany. We see a lot of people questioning attitudes towards Germany's past. We see people thinking openly that perhaps the Holocaust Mahnmal in Berlin is actually a shameful thing for their country. These are things that were expressed in their private homes on a Friday night, perhaps previously after a good few years, but now they are becoming salon fame. And I'm very worried about this. I've been researching German-Israeli relations for 25 years, and I'm more worried now than I was ever before. What will be the base for future German-Israeli relations? I think this is one of the challenges that many of the younger people here in the hall will have to face, and will have to find new baselines for cooperation in a world that's becoming more turbulent. Thank you very much. Thank you.